from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. In rebuilding our public schools, education policy expert David Kerb says we should stick to what works, like quality early education for children and creating word-rich curriculums. In other words, avoid getting carried away by quick fixes and the latest trends. His new book is Improbable Scholars. It tells the success story of Union City, New Jersey, and it argues that that success story can stand for the nation. We'll hear all about it after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to another hour of the Forum program. David Kerb joins us in studio for this Forum Hour, a longtime education policy expert and author. He discovered a blueprint for successful public education in the unlikely, crowded, largely poor and Latino inner-city school district of Union City, New Jersey, once one of the worst-performing school systems in the state. David Kerb is professor of public policy at the Goldman School of Public Policy at University of California, Berkeley, and he's the author of 17 books, many articles. He's appeared in the New York Times, the LA Times, Nation, Atlantic, and American Prospect, and served on President Obama's 2008 transition team. His newest book is called Improbable Scholars, The Rebirth of a Great American School System and a Strategy for America's Schools, and joins us for this hour. Good to have you back on Forum.
Good to be here, Michael.
Well, as I said, this would be an unlikely poster child for most people, but it's become, in many respects, a model for what American public education can be. Inner city, diminution of the achievement gap. And what's so amazing about this story is that we're actually talking about an inner city school that is competitively, in terms of reading, writing, and math, on a scale with any suburban school, and probably, close to 90% graduation rate, too?
That's the wake-up call. There's a 90% graduation rate. 75% of the kids enroll in college now. And this is an almost all Latino, very poor, maybe a third of the kids are there without documentation. Three-quarters of them come from homes where Spanish is the language of the table. I mean, this is the kind of district where kids are expected to not make it, and they're making it big time.
And they're making it big time for reasons which you delineate in your new book. But a lot of it, initially at least, let's start at the beginning, has to do with pre-K. I mean, they're willing to spend for the preschools.
They are indeed. But I think it's important to say we've heard a lot about miracle cures. You know, we walk right into the middle of the success story. But as you said in the introduction, it's been a 20-year process and a slow, steady, tortoise beats hare story. But yeah, preschool is key to this. There's a landmark decision in New Jersey that requires all the poor districts in the state to offer 2 years of preschool funded by the state. And many of the districts poo-pooed it as kind of babysitting. Union City just leapt in with 2 feet, and they have built out of public schools, nonprofits, for-profits, city-run schools, a really great educational system, which both introduces the kids to English, but also to very hands-on, very project-oriented learning. Those preschools make you wish you were 3 years old again.
Of course, if you want to invest in preschools, as President Obama is probably finding out as we speak here, perhaps, you really have to have the politicians on board. You had Union City Mayor, who was also a state senator. That helped. But reality is that a lot of politicians are very resistant.
It did, and I've never understood this, because if you look at all the poll data, early education polls, overwhelmingly positive. And it's not a partisan issue. It really does cross blue-red lines. So, you know, note to Republicans, if you wanted to pick something to make yourselves look like the kinder, gentler party, this would be a greater issue to pick up. I mean, all the old, my God, those kids belong at home with mom is all gone because mom is working. And I think everybody by now sees the kind of impact that really good early education can have.
I mentioned that you had certainly a good mayor, in that he, at least politically, in that he was tied to the state senate. But you also have a principal here who talks about our house and our family and ties the school to the community, the whole sense of well, rules, too. No cursing, no bullying, no tardiness, all of those kinds of things. And actually a dress code that can't be deviated from.
Well, this is the high school you're talking about now. But
I'm all the way to high school. I've made the jump.
So. This is okay. Well, I think, though, that's fine because that set of attitudes really is suffused throughout the system.
Preschool lays the groundwork.
Lays the groundwork, but that same, we're a community, we're in this together, we're setting high expectations. It's a very warm place, a very caring place. And all of you mentioned those rules, which are there, the no bullying, no cursing, no lateness. They're all tied into it's our house, it's our community. This is how you respect our community. And the kids get it. I remember talking to an eighth grade teacher, not a particularly great, lively teacher. She was teaching math, and she was saying that a new student had shown up in school and behind her back was saying nasty things about her. And the other kid said, "What are you doing?" And they said they went up to the teacher and said to her, "We've got your back." This is not what you expect to find in any school, let alone an inner city school.
There's a real attitude about helping struggling students and a very strong attitude about we can do it attitude that you write about in the book. And all this is sort of in some ways coming from the top, yeah?
Well, I think it's coming from every place there. This is not one of the great leader stories. This is not a hero story. The superintendent is a solid guy. I call the chapter about the administration grunt work, and a lot of it is. There have been some important people along the way that have helped kickstart the process. But it's very much baked into the system so that if the top guy leaves, there's somebody else there to replace him or her. And that's why I have some reasonable confidence to believe that this isn't a one-shot wonder. Indeed, the continuing improvement of that system, most recently through the high schools, as you were describing, there's no reason why that shouldn't continue because they're on a very solid course of continuous improvement.
We're talking to David Kirp, the author of Improbable Scholars, which tells the success story of Union City, New Jersey, and argues essentially that all our public schools can benefit from what was learned there. How do they deal read the book, but maybe you can talk specifically about how they were able to deal with a bilingual problem because, as you said, you have a lot of undocumented and bilingual people.
Well, they don't have the ideological barriers that California does. That is to say, nobody's arguing against speaking Spanish because all the linguists will tell you that it's really important to be thoroughly grounded, to be fluent in your native language before you transition to English. And that means reading, writing, as well as speaking. And so that's what they do. And then slowly, they develop this very finely granulated program. So the kids are grouped in tables in classes. And there's very little sitting in rows. There's a lot of sitting at tables on the basis both of where they are in language, where they are moving on that path to English, and where they are academically. So it's very hard on the teacher because the teacher's got to prepare multiple lessons depending upon all those gradations. But it's great for the students. It's, by the way, the kind of thing that can only work if you've got the money to run small classes because the teacher is developing four or five different curricula, but it's much easier to do that when you've got four kids at a table and 15 kids in your classroom.
Can we do this in California where the Latino population in public schools is so high and a textbook example of the achievement gap and students not graduating high school? Do we have the revenue to do it here?
Well, we are doing it in California. I mean, I write in the book about Sanger, which is a little farm town just outside of Fresno. And I mean, Sanger has, maybe half the money that Union City does. So it can't do it all. It can only do a limited amount of pre-K. It can't be fancy in terms of what it offers at the high school. But it gets those kids through in increasing numbers.
But it doesn't have the big classes that you have in the urban areas. That's
well, right. Then we can turn to Long Beach and Garden Grove, which are big cities. What's interesting, when I finished looking at Union City, I put on my policy cap and said, gee, I wonder what's happening in other districts around the country where the achievement gap is closing and where achievement rates are rising faster than you might expect given the kids. And they are all more or less doing the same kind of thing. It's a very slow, steady, continuous improvement. There's no high drama. There's no massive school closing, firing principals, firing teachers. There's no Michelle Rhee on the scene to stir the pot. This is just solid, steady, build a system.
Since you mentioned Michelle Rhee, she's been on this program. So has Diane Ravitch. They are kind of, in my mind, great polarized examples of sort of approach to educational reform. And you're talking about long term. You're talking about, use the word grunt and all that. This is not a quick fix. But there are many people who feel, especially after waiting for Superman, we need charters and we need to have vouchers and we need, that kind of strategy where teachers are rewarded and pay on what they can produce in tests and so forth. And essentially that's, from your perspective, something that's not only not working, but it's not going to work.
That's right. I mean, we have no evidence that charters as a whole work, and we certainly have no evidence that vouchers work. And indeed, what's going on in Louisiana with the voucher part of the program is nothing less than scandalous. There are great charters. I'm a great fan of the KIPP schools, for example. They do wonderful things. But you can't educate 60-plus million kids in charter schools. It's not going to happen. So if charters went back to their original purpose, that charters were supposed to be innovative laboratories for education, which would inform and improve public schools, that would be great. What we've got now is increasingly for-profit chains of charters, not very good, that see themselves as the antagonists of the public schools. In Los Angeles not so long ago, there was an election, and Michelle Rhee, among others, Joel Klein, Rupert Murdoch, chipped in $4 million to defeat a school board candidate whose sin was that he thought, we've got to slow down on approving of all these charters and weed out the bad ones. He, by the way, he won. But this is high-stakes game. This is very much a moment of serious conflict.
Well, Condoleezza Rice, I think, was on that same group that you mentioned with Joel Klein, the former New York public school chancellor. And they're saying, well, you know, if you got charter schools, you got vouchers, you got more choice. And you can shut down failing schools and get teachers bounced when they're not doing the job and not getting the tests. And this seems to appeal to a large segment of the population.
Well, I can understand why. And as I say, in looking at teachers in Union City and elsewhere, there are certainly teachers who shouldn't be teaching. I mean, they need to be counseled out of that profession or nudged out of that profession. Because, you know, there are the handful of time servers and there are the handful of teachers who, as I discovered, actually hate kids.
And teachers who are being protected by the unions. Let's call
it. Yeah, no, exactly. And, you know, but I do think that the unions have been pushed. And I do credit, the folks who believe in this set of values for pushing the unions into being more responsive about the way they deal with incompetent members of the profession, as opposed to protecting them, they weed them out. And where you've got a strong union and an administration that invites the union into the conversation, these conflicts don't exist. So that in Montgomery County, Maryland, for example, there is a board equally comprised of principals and teachers. They evaluate teachers who aren't doing well on a whole variety of metrics, not just those reading and math scores. And they love bomb those teachers with support. And if after a year or so they're not making it, those teachers are fired. And this is a decision made both by principals and by teachers working together, and it works. So if we create these deep antagonisms, we're going to get the union off in its corner and the other folks off in their corner, and nothing good is going to happen for the kids.
You've got an article in, I believe it's the new issue of The Nation, all about testing, and testing has been, from many people's perspective, overemphasized. But I suppose one of the salient arguments in opposition to testing is it just encourages cheating.
Well, that's one of them. I mean, the reason testing encourages cheating, and cheating by teachers and administrators, not cheating by kids.
Right.
Most recently Atlanta. And by the way, John Merrow, PBS correspondent, has been very hot on the trail of Michelle Rhee for covering up a widespread cheating episode in Washington, D.C.
That came up when she was on the air, and of course she denied it.
Well, it's the document – this is one of those in which the smoking gun document is out. And there actually exist contracts that she negotiated with principals that spoke to what they were going to get by way of improvement. The same kind of thing happened in Atlanta. Beverly Hall was actually a much more effective superintendent during her tenure there in Atlanta than Michelle Rhee ever was. But that push to get those achievement scores up, when you tell schools they've got to work miracles and they have no idea how to work miracles, and the teachers and principals are told your livelihood depends on it, it's not an excuse for teaching for cheating, but it's an explanation for cheating.
You say no quick fixes, no miracle cures. And this is you're talking about a long-term strategy here, not only early education, but supportive teachers and outreach to parents, very important too. And what do you mean when you talk about cognitive emphasis?
Well, any teacher knows.
Latkes and pie, right?
Latkes and pie. There you go. Any teacher knows that if you just are focusing relentlessly on reading and math, you're going to miss so much about those kids and their futures. And if you look at the data, as everybody these days is wont to do, kids who are high on cognitive scales at age 3 are doing better in high school than kids who are just high on the emotional social scales. Not as high as the difference isn't as great as you'd think. But the kids who were doing well in terms of work and play well together, those kids, the kids who are feeling okay about themselves at age three, they're less likely to drop out. They're less likely to be on drugs. They're less likely to be abusing alcohol. They're less likely as teenagers to get pregnant. They're less likely to be in jail. All those factors that we care enormously about have to do with how you feel about yourself and how you connect with others. And teachers know this, and parents know this. It's just that the folks who are test fixated don't get this. And don't get me wrong, I am not an anti-test guy. I think you've got to assess students. You need to know where they are. We have just turned, you know, the value of tests into a kind of test mania.
Our guest is David L. Kirp, and he is a professor of public policy in the Goldman School of Public Policy at UC Berkeley, also a member of President Obama's 2008 Education Policy Transition Team, and the author of Improbable Scholars, A Rebirth of a Great American School System and a Strategy for American Schools. Of course, when we talk about the achievement gap and how important it is, I want to get back to latkes and pie. I just don't want to just drop that. But there's the other gap. I mean, average students in the United States are performing far below average students in a number of other countries. I mean, Mark Tucker had a whole article, which I'm sure you're familiar with, in Education Weekly, and outlined that. I mean, maybe our bar is simply too low in general.
Oh, I think that's right. But if you look, for example, if you took New Jersey as a country, New Jersey isn't doing badly on those international tests. If you compare likes to likes, we're not doing as badly as the alarmist suggests. But overall, yes, there is indeed a real problem. And it hasn't gotten any better. It's not as though under the No Child Left Behind regime, which is high-stakes testing and punishment for schools and teachers that don't meet that bar, it's not as though that the achievement gap is closing, and it's not as though test scores have been improving over that period of time. So, yeah, we have set the bar too low, and here's where I've got great hope for these new national standards. They really do push thinking, problem-solving, critical analysis much harder than we have in the past. And the trick is going to be whether or not those new national standards become the basis for exciting, innovative, engaged teaching or become an occasion for more and more and more testing, which winds up driving out all the excitement that's going to lead you to those results. The countries that are doing really well on the international exam do not fetishize testing. Finland, which is the poster child example these days, right? They don't begin formal school until age seven. The teachers are very well selected, but given a lot of autonomy, chances to work together. Those kids aren't tested a lot during the time that they're in school. And when they take the international exams, they do fabulously.
When the Finnish example is brought up, and Singapore is also another good example, immediately people will respond by saying, these are homogenous populations. These are much more tractable than, sprawling and diffuse populations.
No, that's absolutely right. I mean, the other thing that people would bring up about Finland, and appropriately so, is that it's a socialist state in the good sense of a socialist state. I mean, the income inequality is very small. That makes for a huge difference in terms of the kids' opportunities. Nonetheless, there isn't a country in the world that is a high-performing country that operates with the kind of system that the market-oriented folks want. There isn't a single other country that focuses on charter schools, let alone thinks about vouchers. These are countries with very strong, very effective public school systems. That's because they've realized, and we're talking about China and Korea. These are not Singapore and Finland. These are countries that realize that you can't do it. You can't rely on some version of a market to provide education for millions and millions of kids.
Sounds good to capitalist-minded people, though, like when Michelle Rhee or Arne Duncan talk the way they do about quick fixes and maybe, from your perspective, simply too good to be true.
Let's talk about capitalism for a second. There was a GM plant that we know down here in Fremont. That was in the 1970s, one of the disaster plants of all time. A lot of drinking, a lot of drugs. Toyota winds up partnering with GM. If ever there was an occasion to close the place and fire everybody, it was that. But that's not what Toyota did. It took those workers. It brought them to Japan. It showed them a system of continuous improvement, which interestingly looks a lot like what Union City does for its teachers, brought them back. And that plant, the NUMMI plant, became the most efficient GM plant in the country. So if when money is on the line, people believe that you can improve workers and change culture, that you don't fire everybody and close schools. And by the way, there is no data that says school closures are a recipe for improvement. But if money is on the line, surely that ought to be a lesson to the rest of us.
So let's talk about latkes since I mentioned them. I mean, it's an interesting example.
It is. I love the latke story. As I said, if you want to sort of see the best teaching in the world, you know, you owe it to yourself to go visit a really good preschool class. And in the one that Michael is referencing, here are these little Latino kids who probably have never seen a Jewish boy or girl in their lives. And they're learning about making latkes, which are potato pancakes. And from the very beginning, from picking up the potato, from smelling it, from feeling it, all the way to cutting it up, to using graters, to the potato falls in the floor and the teacher says, you know, this is what happens. What cooks do, they wipe the potato off and they go back to cleaning. To, is the potato gonna smell differently? What about the onion? How is that going to change when you cook it? This is a teaspoon. This is a tablespoon. Let's look at the difference between those. And all the way to cooking the latkes, every moment in that. And by the way, this is a story that began with these kids reading a wonderful tale about this Bubi Brena, who, nearsighted, great maker of latkes, confused the wolf for the rabbi in the town. So they're there. They're primed for this. And when they make those latkes and I come back and I get to try the latkes, they're fabulous. And they serve them with sour cream. The traditional
really
Jewish way.
To be fabulous.
They're really good. They were very good. They're not the leaden latkes, but they serve them with salsa. A great improvement.
And then the pie, I mean, we always talk about, you know, cutting up the pie economically and socially and so forth. And this works again in preschool?
No, El Pie, which is this concept that this third grade teacher who I hung out with for a long time uses. And she says, you know, the class is a pie. And we're all part of the pie. We're different slices. There's the pepperoni. You can think of yourself as mushroom, as veggie, as whatever, sausage pizza, everything pizza. But we're all part of the same pie. So she's really emphasizing, and throughout the entire term, she's emphasizing that we're a community. We're different people. We have our own differences and our own individuality. But we really are one group. And that message, it's a lovely metaphor. But in different ways, shapes, and forms, from preschool through high school, that's when the principal in the high school is talking about, this isn't the way we are. This isn't who we are. He's talking about the pie, just using different language.
And what constitutes the best form of early childhood education? I mean, the emphasis on the cognitive and the emphasis on the kinds of things you're talking about, but and the whole, we're all together in this, but what more?
Well, it is. I mean, when you talk about preschool, there's no way that you could not be paying attention to the emotional lives of these kids. You watch them trying to work together, sorting out problems with each other, fighting and dealing with fighting, learning how to control their own emotions, learning how to take turns, even as they're learning how to solve problems and think through sets of issues. And watching that combination of things going on all at once, because you can't disentangle these things. You know, if a kid is really feeling badly about herself, she's not going to learn very well. And a kid who's feeling great about himself may very well need lots of booster shots in order to be really exploring and really being interested. But these kids, I think of these kids as little Lewis's and Clark's. They're little explorers. And a great teacher is gonna help them along the way, is going to ask them questions, is going to nurture that discovery. And when you see what they produce, you know, whether it's the artwork or the stories or the little plays that they make up or the graphing problems and the math problems they deal with, it's fabulous.
Talking to David Kirp and talking about how to find success in public schools. His book is about school reform. He's been at this for many years. The new book is called Improbable Scholars. It tells the success story of Union City, New Jersey. And you may want to join this conversation talking about the achievement gap, the ongoing battle between educational reformers who put the emphasis on things like charters and vouchers and choice, and those who feel perhaps it's a long uphill climb. But let's go back to I guess what I'd call old school. Let me invite you to join us. Our toll-free number is available. It's 866-733-6786, and you can join us now at that number, toll-free, 866-733-6786. You can also email us, forum@kqed.org, or join us by going to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment, and we welcome tweeting. Our Twitter handle is @KQED Forum. You can also go to our Facebook page. Many ways to communicate, but let's hear from you. Any questions or comments are welcome. David Kirp, again, is the James D. Marver Professor of Public Policy at the Goldman School of Public Policy at UC Berkeley and the author of Improbable Scholars. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. You're listening to Forum, and our guest this hour is David Kirp. And in rebuilding our public schools, David Kirp, who is an education policy expert, says we should stick with what works, like quality early childhood education and creating word-rich curricula. In other words, avoid getting carried away by quick fixes and the latest trends. His new book is Improbable Scholars. It tells the success story of Union City, New Jersey, and it argues that all our public schools can benefit from what was learned there. Let's learn what's on your minds, and let's go to our callers, and we begin, Victoria, with you. Good morning.
Hi, good morning. I'm calling from Stanford, and I actually went to Stanford's Graduate School of Education and got my my master's in policy, organization, and leadership studies. And I left the program. I graduated, but after finishing the program, I was very jaded with the educational system. And I quickly realized as I was going through the program that we tend to fixate on education as the solution to the disparities that we see manifesting within the educational arena, rather than looking at many of the social issues that are contributing to the disparities that we see. I feel as if we don't talk about the role of racism, the role of poverty, and these other issues that have an impact on how a child feels about themselves, or how a teacher feels about that child. And if you come to school and you see all these images of, let's say, blackness as negative, and you know, you have people at school, from the administrators to the teachers to the students, confirming negative ideas about blackness or ideas that they hold about blackness, how do you expect for a child to feel that great about themselves? Or if a child is poor or their mom or dad is unemployed, how do you expect for them to have that confidence that's needed for them to perform well in school?
Victoria, you're throwing out a question with many dimensions to it here. We get back to, in my mind, if I may, David, a book many years ago published by Jonathan Kozol called Death at an Early Age. And, you know, the idea being that just what Victoria is bringing up here, that kids have, what John Vasconcelos calls self assertion problem or a self-value problem, and the institutions seem to some extent exacerbate that, so the argument goes.
Well, there are two big strands, I thought, in what Victoria had to say, and it's all very thoughtful stuff. The one has to do with this tension between culture, race, social class, poverty, and education. And they're both important. It's very hard to imagine anybody who would say, you know, you come to school and you're all equal. It doesn't matter what life is like out of school. Of course, those things have a huge effect. And in a place like Union City, they do everything they can to support, provide, help those kids. The preschool teacher you mentioned says, I want these kids to have what I give my own kids. And she obviously can't overcome all the disadvantages. But school is the biggest institution we have. And in this political climate, it's hard to imagine us redistributing resources. The other point is the one that you were just focusing on, which is how kids come to school and their sense of themselves. What Claude Steele, who's now the education dean at Stanford, talks about is stereotype vulnerability. It's real, it's important, and is clearly something that schools need to pay attention to. And I think, again, what a great school system or a great teacher will do is give kids the positive reinforcement they need, not tell them, oh, you can't make it, or oh, we can't expect much from you, but build into this the kind of the sky's the limit notion. So that in Union City, to pick an example, although 90% of the kids are graduating, a lot of them are just slipping through. They've been pushed through that system, and they're going to have a hard time in college. So they're raising the bar there. In a couple of years, they're going to require that all kids take the preliminary SAT test. Now, that says to these kids, you know, we're going to support you, we're going to help you, and we're going to set high expectations for you and for the teachers in this system. It's not just good enough. And it would be great if other places were able to address that set of questions as well.
Well, yeah, Victoria, thank you so much for the call. A lot of hands-on work from the teachers at Union City, which you note in your book. And Laurie notes on our website, finally a voice of reason and someone who knows what they are talking about. As a former public school teacher, this is very refreshing. I especially like what he said about these great and improving public schools doing it all together with no heroes or big personalities. Bravo. But David writes, how do we turn around failing schools given the overwhelming data that suggests turnarounds rarely work? Union City is an exception. How can you scale the practices at Union City across other large districts with contracts, that limit school leaders' ability to transform the work environment? Lastly, the problem with bilingual education is the fact that it is viewed as a problem. It is actually an opportunity. Until we embrace the value in multiple languages in California, we'll continue to struggle to educate our students.
I would say that David and I are exactly on the same page. The challenge in Union City, when I finished writing the book, I thought people are going to say this is a great story, but it's small and they've got a lot of money and the mayor actually appoints the school board, so there's some degree of stability. But you can look at a place like Long Beach or Montgomery County, 18th biggest district in the country, or a place called Aldine, Texas, dirt poor, Houston's poor cousin, bigger than Washington, D.C., bigger than Boston, and watch how they've implemented this. It's slow, steady, hard work. As David says, there's no evidence that turnaround schools work. Indeed, one of the great turnaround schools that Arne Duncan lauded in Chicago, that Barack Obama visited not so long ago, has just been closed as part of the school closures because it's now a failing school. Well, there's just something wrong with this notion that in 2 years, a school that's supposed to be a great success is now a failing school. So we need – this is a very hard message for parents, but for systems – it's really important to be able to build on successes, and where you need to change personnel, indeed, to find ways of changing those union contracts so that you've got more flexibility than you now have.
And I think I've made it clear, but we're talking about Union City, New Jersey, not Union City, California, just so we don't have any confusion on that. We asked our Facebook page for suggestions as to what would improve America's schools. Just to give you a couple of responses, Hugh writes, you know what might help? Spending as much on education as we do on prisons. That'd be a start. Noah says, revoking Proposition 13 in California. I mean, it gets down to economics in many people's minds. But I talk to you about something else. I want to bring up Frank Bruni's column. But let me actually bring up another caller first. And that's Debbie. Hi.
Hi. So my question is, I was educated in the magnet program for most of K through 12. And I feel like I had a great education and went on to do well in college and everything. But I know that some see the magnet programs as a way to keep white kids in public schools by giving them maybe smaller classrooms or better teachers. And I wanted to know what you think, what you both think of the magnet program.
Well, let me go back to the dollars question that came up in your Facebook suggestion and then take up Debbie's comment. It's clear that, as I said, if you don't have a lot of money, there are many things that you'd want to do that you can't do. You can't provide, most importantly, the kind of preschool that you're interested in. You can't provide the small classes that let teachers do hands-on work. And there isn't a teacher out there in the world who will say there isn't a huge difference between 15 kids and 30 kids in the classroom. You can't provide the array of opportunities that a place like Union City, New Jersey does at the high school level. I think it's scandalous. I think it's criminal that we spend as little in California as we do, and I want to applaud the voters of the state for approving a tax increase, which ameliorates the situation slightly. But we're still at the bottom of the barrel.
Slightly is the right
slightly.
Word here, yeah.
And we have a long, long ways to go in educating folks about the need to be able to do that. Magnet schools, well, you know, if you attract – you put your finger on the right question. If you can attract students from across the board to interesting, exciting schools that keeps, you know, minority kids as well as – white kids in school, that's great. But generally, the reason for the common school is very practical. Poor families move a lot. They often will move two and three times a year. In Atlanta, they move three times between districts, much more than that within districts. You don't want a kid to get lost when they move from place to place. And so a school system like Union City or Montgomery County, Maryland, has a common curriculum. The teachers get to vary it at the margins. They get to pick the supplemental books they want, so that when you're studying word problems in one school, you're not studying number problems at another school. You're not reading Lord of the Flies three times during the course of your high school education.
It's good to have that continuity, but at the same time, when kids move from school to school, it's pretty disruptive.
It is, and this is the only way you can minimize the disruption. Indeed, by providing them with something as close to what they had. You know, there are limits. This is, again, this goes back to the point about what can schools do. Being poor, a working definition of being poor is that you've got terrible choices. And moving isn't something that people love to do. It's something that they're forced to do. So what can the schools do? At the margin, they can provide as familiar an environment as possible for the kids as they move.
Let me thank the caller, Debbie, and go on to another caller, and that's Nancy. Good morning. Nancy, are you there?
Yes. Hi. Sorry. I just wanted to say that I think preschools are the most fantastic part of the public school system. My kids, one of which is going to be 46 and one of them is going to be 40, went to the Berkeley Cooperative Preschools. It was the best education they had until college, or with my daughter, high school. It was cooperative. You know, parents participated one day a week. It was run through the Berkeley Public Schools, but it was run through adult education. And so there was, every month or so, there was a meeting with the parents that we had to go to. And it was cost $20 a semester. And it was fantastic. I laugh when the gentleman mentioned latkes. We made latkes. We celebrated Cinco de Mayo. It was a very mixed group of kids, Latino, African-American, white, Asian. And the teachers were superb. It was absolutely wonderful. And, of course, it doesn't exist anymore. And it's really sad. I think, you know, preschool is needs to be instituted in every school district throughout the country, and preferably free or very, very low income spending preschools.
Well, that's what, thank you, Nancy, what the Obama administration is trying to bring about. What do you think, thank you again, Nancy, about play-based preschools?
So the key word in Nancy's description is quality. And I actually think that the best, I agree with her, some of the very best teaching is done in preschools. And nationally, more and more school districts are offering preschools. That's the good news. But the bad news is they're offering it on the cheap. They think it's going to work on the cheap. So that nationwide, the average K-12 expenditure is $12,000. The average preschool expenditure is now under $4,000. There's just no way you can provide the kind of education that Nancy was describing or the kind of education that I describe in Improbable Scholars for that kind of money.
When my older daughter was young, there was a co-op preschool that I was the parent in, and that really worked very well. And as a model, I mean, it was not only really good teachers and everything, but the parents were very involved. It was very hands-on with the parents. In fact, I remember once the leader of that preschool said, Michael, you and the other mothers, come here. We'll be doing something. But there's more of, I think, an involvement when you have the parents that are involved on any level. I mean, co-op would be the ideal, but you can't always have a co-op preschool. So getting parents involved in preschool, singularly important.
Getting parents involved, period.
Well, in all public education.
Singularly important. And parents are much more likely to get involved in preschool because they can see where they can be helpful. But, you know, a good school system, it has to realize, and this goes back to the conversation earlier from Victoria, about, you know, the what's going on outside of school. A good school system has to realize that if parents aren't engaged, if the family isn't supportive, the school is really sort of racing much, much more uphill. It's having a much harder time. So again, it's being able to speak in the language, being able to provide help for parents, finding ways of being flexible. Because, I mean, in the days that you were a parent, those moms were staying home. Those moms aren't home anymore. So the preschool and the other schools have to work around this, have to figure out ways of getting moms there before school, after school, on odd days off, on outings, on whatever. And getting those parents to understand that whatever their own educational backgrounds are, they have a lot that they can help their kids with in terms of their own education.
And what about play-based preschools?
Well, this is another one of these phony
quick fixes.
Well, it's, you know, there's play and there's cognitive. I mean, in fact, both are going to be going on, right? I mean, you can't just sit kids down and drill them in letters and numbers. As the teacher that I write about in Improbable Scholars said, I could teach a parrot to count from 1 to 10. It's not interesting to me. But, you know, what we call play as an adult really can be a very exciting learning experience.
It goes back to the idea, I think, in my mind, of A.S. Neal and Summerhill and all these experiments where they said, just let kids play and they'll learn. But there has to be guidance. There has to be instruction. There has to be some kind of pedagogical tools that are brought into it.
Right. Rousseau had the same observation a couple of centuries ago. We're all noble savages. But, you know, that's a problem. Indeed, what you want a teacher to do with preschool is to be giving kids the tools that they can really learn from and play with. And when the kids get stumped, there's the teacher to ask questions, to prod the kid into thinking. It is play. It's learning. It's getting a sense of yourself as an emotional human being. It's working with others. It's the whole complete package in preschool. I love it. When Union City discovered that its kindergartens – realized that its kindergartens looked more like little first grades. They were prepping their kids for exams almost. They brought the preschool master teachers in to realign kindergarten so that they would look more like preschool. And the kindergarten teachers, who were really nervous about this, said, walk in and see them now. They love it. It's hard to teach this way. It's hard to teach with lots of different groups of kids doing one thing. The teacher's got to have eyes, you know, in the back of her head, the side of her head, every place. But again, to see what learning goes on and what joy is in those places, you know, it would be a pick-me-up. For anybody who's just in despair about the education system, go see what's happening in a good preschool.
I mentioned Frank Burney's column, which you may have seen, listeners may have seen in the New York Times this weekend. It was entitled America the Clueless, and I just want to mention a few things that he notes in the column. About 65% of Americans can't name a single Supreme Court justice. Despite all the discussion about Obamacare, roughly 40% of Americans don't even know that it is a law on the books. So Bruni writes, quote, "We mostly gloss over our ignorance or deny it. Should the U.S. public education system be responsible for this?"
You know, we have had surveys like this, as you know, since the year zero, and you really can't, you know, what was the old line? You can't go wrong underestimating American intelligence. I care. I care about that. I care that people don't know stuff. It's sort of it's amazing when you understand the basis for people's votes, you sort of marvel that the system works. But what worries me more is how well people are thinking, how well people are solving problems, how well people are analyzing issues. And when you've got a system that focuses on get folks ready for that test and get them prepped for that test, two things happen. The thinking goes out the window. And they've got all this short-term memory, but then when they get out in the world, they have no way of absorbing information. They have no way of learning on their own. So in that context, yes, I think you can say that the schools in their focus on stuff that doesn't really matter and not getting people excited about learning over some period of time bear some responsibility for the fact that we don't know a lot as a people. And, you know, surprise, surprise. You look at the data from 1960, you look at the data from 1920, it looks exactly the same in terms of what people didn't know.
Wait a minute, was that Barnum or Mencken or Twain? Who did say that? I'm conflating it.
Somebody on the air will answer this question for us, Michael.
Somebody please do. We'll get to Neil on. Neil, you're next. Hi.
Mencken.
It was Mencken. Yeah, thank you.
Thank you, Neil.
Yes. I'm kind of wondering, is there anything that can be done at the federal level on education? Do you really think that the federal level would be able to do anything in terms of what you want? And the second question is, what do you think of the system in which all of the property taxes for education would be combined into a single education fund and then distributed equally to every district in the state?
So those are two big policy questions. Let me take them in that order. As we were talking about earlier, President Obama has a proposal to build a high-quality 0-5 system of support for all kids. And quality, again, is the key. The problem in Washington is that I think many of those legislators miss the preschool lesson about working and playing well together. I mean, that is a frozen place. So I'm not optimistic in the near future that good stuff is going to come out of Washington. Turning to Governor Brown's proposal, I do think districts need a lot more flexibility. We have many, many too many narrowly channeled programs. So there is something called transitional kindergarten, which really ought to be preschool. It's just not. It sort of looks more like kindergarten. And the same kinds of kids in bigger classes with a different set of requirements, only because it comes out under a different set of rules. So giving districts more flexibility is important. It's also important to look at how that money gets spent, because the concern is you're going to give money to districts with more poor kids. You want to make sure that some of that money actually is spent on poor kids and not just generally distributed to the schools.
Yeah, you want to outline for listeners David Krupp's golden rule for education?
Well, just generally. I mean, this is David Krupp's rule for kids, and that is when I look at a school system or I look at a program, you know, the question is it good enough for a child that I love? That's the standard. That ought to be the policy standard that we apply. And it doesn't mean that it has to be fancy. It means it has to be solid. It has to be caring. It has to be focused on kids' thinking. It has to respect kids. It has to nurture kids. And there are lots of places. Union City is one example. But when I've traveled around the country looking at schools, and earlier when I was looking at a whole array of other programs, parent support programs, community organization programs, there's a lot of it out there. The problem is that it isn't being put together, and it's really hit or miss whether any child gets that experience.
Here's Elizabeth, who says, "Seems to me that the anti-testing sentiment is reaching such a fever pitch for totally understandable reasons, as you note, these days. I fear we're about to see the pendulum swing hard the other way, from high-stakes accountability to abandonment of reliable measures of student progress. I would hate to see the promise of the Common Core standards be undone just because people fear the tests related to them as a kind of boogeyman. How do you see those of us with a more balanced understanding of the practical use of assessment responding to the situation?"
I think you're absolutely right. And in the book, when I talk about tests in very much those terms, you need assessments and you need to be able to work with the assessments. And Common Core, which I was mentioning earlier, with its focus on problem solving, with its focus on critical thinking, is a chance to make a new start. And the question is, can we devise tests that actually, if you teach to the test, you're teaching to a really good education? Because now, if you teach to the test, you look at those schools, and I write about one of these elementary schools that I hung out in for a long time, that as the test approach, I call that period where fun goes to die. And it's just a miserable time because there's so much focus on these reading and math tests. And the poorer the kids are, the schools in the poorer neighborhoods, the more that focus, the more the joy is drained out of learning. And is it really any surprise that those kids get turned off by education in the next couple of years? So, yeah, I'm in total agreement with Elizabeth. This is the moment of the Common Core standards to rethink the value and the limitations of testing in our education system.
And a listener named Gretchen writes, thank you so much for bringing David Kirp onto the show. As an early childhood educator and advocate, I've spent nearly 20 years trying to make the high-quality practices of early childhood more visible. We need more people like him who get it and can help change the hearts and minds of those who control funding. Early childhood teachers are not babysitters. When they do their jobs well, they are doing the most important job for our society. You're listening to Forum. We're talking with David Kirp, and this is a fundraising period for KQED Public Radio. For more information about how to support KQED, simply go to kqed.org. I'm Michael Krasny. And we'll go to another call, and that's Pat from Vacaville. Hi, Pat.
Hi. Well, I've been troubled by how much of the onus has been put on unions for incompetent teachers, when, in fact, there is a mechanism within the schools that would find these incompetent teachers. And the fact is, the administrations hire these teachers in the first place. And they have 3 years in which to look at these teachers and find out if they're doing their jobs. One of the things I worked on when I was, I taught at a high school south of here, south of San Francisco. And it was my idea, you know, not to have the principal come in and we do a dog and pony show. It was my idea that the principal or the vice principal would have to look at the work the students were doing. So when I brought in my, I was an English teacher, when I brought in the essays, it would show that the kids had done at least a second draft, sometimes a third draft. I would be able to show that work, and it would be the same across disciplines with math or science. So instead of looking at the test every semester, here was a way to look at the teacher's performance across time.
Let me get a response from that call, Pat, from what you said in your call. David Kirp.
Pat, I certainly am not anti-union. If you look at the data that school districts that are unionized actually do slightly better than school districts that are not unionized. And I totally agree with you that when you're assessing teachers just using tests and the so-called, quote, value add of the test score increase from year to year is, for so many reasons that we don't have time to go into, a crazy way to be about doing this. And looking at portfolios and array of work and sitting in and observing what classrooms are like and whether or not the teacher is actually engaging the children rather than focusing on getting them to get the right answer, very important part of the story. Finally, we haven't talked about teacher collaboration, but that's how teachers learn. They learn from each other. And so if you want to evaluate teachers, my proposal is, instead of evaluating, you know, Ms. Krasny, third grade teacher, you evaluate all the third grade teachers as a group. That encourages them to work together. That's the kind of incentive you want to build in.
And the whole mentoring is of crucial importance here, too. And let me thank Pat again for her call and get right to another caller. Ken, thanks for waiting. Join us. You're on Forum.
Yes. Probably the best, we had best school system in the country at one point. Then we decided to defund education and call people who went to school stupid. We do not value children. We do not value education. We give it tons of lip service. We give it a little bit of money. And we want miraculous results in a society that doesn't value it in the first place. The only thing we really value now is commerce. If we valued students and learning, we wouldn't even be having this discussion. I know in Norway and in Sweden, they do two things. You have to have a master's degree before you can walk into a classroom and start teaching. Preschool starts at the age of one. It's completely funded. Kids who need more, for whatever reason there is, developmental problems are learned, found out very early in life and addressed. And by the time a kid actually gets to the first grade, you could actually have larger classrooms because everybody's on the same page. And this is, you know, this talking about doing this every year, the same silly discussion, is almost meaningless. There was one person made a very interesting comment. If you want a really good education and live the American dream, go to Sweden.
David Kerr.
Well, we're not in Sweden. We're here. And I agree with you, that we really do need to invest more money in education. And that does mean that all sides in this really crazy warring dispute, is it social background? Is it school? Is it reading math? Is it emotional stuff? All these phony dichotomies need somehow to find a common voice, because without that, we're going to be having the same conversation that Ken is talking about 10 years from now. We're still going to be underfunding schools. And that really is the crime, not just preschools, but schools K through 12 and through higher education as well.
And thank you, Ken, for the call. I want to get another email here from Ashley, who writes, why do we persist in trying to prepare everyone for college? Not everyone is going to go to or should go to college. My brother is very bright but nearly flunked high school because he lacked interest in the academic subjects. He will and does spend hours studying complex technical manuals as part of his job as a pilot. Why not offer technical programs for these students?
Oh, I think that's fine. I don't think that anybody would believe these days that college for everybody makes sense. But you've got to prepare kids for technical careers, which exactly, as is the case with your brother, require a lot of hard thinking.
David Kerr, again, the author of Improbable Scholars, A Rebirth of a Great American School System and a Strategy for America's Schools. Always good to have you with us on Forum. Thank you.
It's a pleasure, Michael.
And we're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11. An hour is repeated 10 to 11 in the evening. Want to extend thanks to our producers, Judy Campbell and Irene Noguchi, and Tina Larberg. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Engagement producer is Amanda Stupai, with online support from David Marks. Senior editor is Dan Zoll, and executive producer is Raul Ramirez. For all of us here at KQED Public Radio, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.